Welcome to the Chelsea Skidmore Show. I am recording this episode at the Comedy Store, and the intro I am recording at home with my baby girl over my shoulder. She's making some noises for you guys, saying what's up. She's about 7 weeks old. Her name is Gia, and you know, I don't know. I'm trying to record the intro and she's crying. So I put her on my shoulder. I think she just wants to be held. You know, there's a lot of figuring out what does this baby need? What does this baby need from me? How can I help her? She's been fed. She's been changed. Now what, you know, raising a baby. That's what I've been up to. That's why I haven't recorded an episode. And I know that like a bunch of my past episodes were a lot of pregnancy related episodes. Sorry if that's not why you tuned into the podcast. You know, I got a bunch of sponsors who sent me some baby gear. So I had to have some pregnancy related episodes. So we're over those. And now I'm back to having regular guests on. My guest today is Richie Stevens. He is an actor and a writer. He just wrote a book called The Gangster's Guide to Sobriety, My Life in the 12 Steps. And he talks about what it was like to be a criminal, a gangster in Ireland. And it's a pretty fun episode, bunch of crazy stories. I think you guys are going to love it. And yeah, you know, I keep going back and forth on like, do I do a birth story episode? But, you know, maybe that's just for the girls on Instagram. Do you guys even care? I don't know. The birth was fucking hard. I was in labor for like 24 hours. It was gnarly. I don't know why some girls pretend it's no big deal. For me, I thought it was pretty wild. You know, squeezing a baby out. Ow. I got a tear, a third degree tear, and I'm healing. You know, I am still healing 7 weeks later. It hurts when I pee. You know, I wasn't stretched out as I thought I was. Compliment to me, compliment to the chef. And I'm just happy to be recording again. I got a bunch of fun guests coming up, and hopefully I could be putting out some episodes every week. And so enjoy this one back, and thank you guys so much for listening. Hi, Richie. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Hey, Chelsea.
Richie, so I have been seeing you around the Comedy Store for years. I don't know, like, probably like 6 years I've seen you walking around. Never knew your story or anything about you. And then all of a sudden I see on Facebook, it says that you're a gangster and, or that you were,
not anymore.
That you were. And I was blown away. And I was with Steven, my husband, who you know. Mm-hmm. And I was like, did you know he was a gangster? And he was like, no. And we were like, what the fuck? And we were just tripping. We're watching The Offer right now. Are you watching that?
Yeah. One of my buddies is in it, Anthony Scordi.
Oh, really?
He's playing Carlo Gambino.
Oh, awesome.
I auditioned for a few roles on it, actually.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's we're loving it. So we're so I'm so excited by the gangster world right now, even though that's Italian and yeah. You're Irish.
I've played Italian gangsters before. I played one on Days of Our Lives.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm probably the only like blonde Italian gangster.
But there are blonde Italians.
Yeah, but not really on TV.
Oh, really? I guess so, because it's like the character of like a dark haired.
Yeah. I got the blue eyes and the blonde hair, but so role.
That's so funny. And love an Irish accent. Let's just loving an accent.
Well, that's how I talk.
I know. Do I have an accent?
Yeah, you have to me. Like, you're just an American accent.
Can you do an American accent?
Sure I can. No, I don't get to play Irish very much.
Really?
I think I've only played one Irish role in all these years. It was for, like, a horror thing for Amazon called Lore.
Uh-huh. Did you start acting when you moved to L.A., or...?
I started just before I moved to L.A., like, I started acting when I was like 30, so mm-hmm. So I'm pretty late to it.
What are you, 34? I mean,
no, late 30s.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No, I started later in life. Like I used to be a carpenter, and then I broke my back in 2011. And
how? From a job?
Yeah, construction accident. I was doing a remodel up in San Francisco, and a beam fell down and hit me and scaffold and broke my back.
Did they give you like a worker's comp?
Yeah, it wasn't very much.
Yeah.
Yeah, but basically, after I hurt myself, I started. That's how I got into acting after that, because you know, I lost all my money and I was broke and I needed a new career. And this girl that I knew, she told me I should try modeling.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, I was 30 and I've been beaten up a lot of times. Like, this nose has been broken a few times and bitten. And there's a
bitten
tooth. Yeah.
A person bit it?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, that's the funny thing as well. Like, the first role I ever got is me, like, tied to a chair and getting crap beaten out of me. And I've played that role three different times in three different projects. And can you hear me?
Just move it closer.
Okay. I'm moving around.
Just, like, breathe on it. Just, like, suck it, you know?
Yeah.
Put
so,
your face in it.
Okay.
Thank you.
That's better? Okay. Yeah, so I've played that role like three times so far in different TV shows and films and stuff. And
yeah.
It really happened to me in real life. Like,
wait, who bit your nose?
All the names are changed in the book, but in the book, yeah. He's called Sullivan. I was like 19 or something back in Ireland, and these guys came to my house one night and barged in and basically held me down and put a knife to my throat and beat me to a pulp, and like they were trying to get information out of me.
Yeah.
And I don't want to tell them, so they like beat the crap out of me, you know. And then at the very end they bit my face.
Oh my god. Is that because you were fighting back or just like the bite?
No, they wanted the information.
Yeah.
They're like they're trying to find out where one of my friends lived, and I didn't want to tell them, so I just took the beating as much as I could, just put my arms up. And
so you're loyal?
Yeah. No, I didn't want them coming to get my friend. And yeah, it happened for about a half hour. They're kicking me on the ground and punching me and knife to my throat. And the guy, like, he went into the kitchen and came out with a bread knife, a big-ass bread knife. And he just, like, he says, "Now, I'm going to ask you some fucking questions, and I want some fucking answers." And I was like, uh-oh. And, he just beat me to a pulp and put the knife to my throat and, like, forced my neck back against the couch, like, so it's almost cutting my head off so I couldn't really move. Yeah.
Whoa. Were you terrified? Did you think you were going to die?
I don't know. I didn't think they were going to kill me, but it wasn't fun.
I feel like we need to backtrack.
Okay.
So how did you get yourself into this world?
Oh, in the very start?
Yeah, let's start from the beginning. You're from Ireland.
Mm-hmm. Born and raised. Yeah. So I came to Ireland like when I was in my early 20s. But when I was a kid, I was kind of shy and quiet, you know. I didn't really I was not like I am now. I was like pretty shy and withdrawn, and I started drinking when I was about 14 or 15. I went to a concert and Beastie Boys and Garbage.
Nice.
It was a pretty fun day. And after the concert, I was on the way home and this girl was drinking some beer, and she handed me a beer, and I was like, drank it. I was like, wow, this is great. Like, you know,
is 14 late for starting drinking in Ireland?
It's probably common enough. At least when I was growing up, it was. I don't know what it's like now. I'm gone nearly 20 years, but. But when I was a kid, like that was normal enough. Maybe I was a slightly late bloomer, maybe mm-hmm. 13 might have been. But once I started drinking, I was like, this is great. You know, I don't care what anybody thinks about me. You know, I can relax. You know, it kind of gave me confidence. So once I started drinking, I was doing it all the time. Right. And in Ireland, it's 18 to drink in a bar or a club.
Mm-hmm.
And so I couldn't get into the clubs, but I wanted to get into the clubs because I wanted to, like, party with the adults and score with the women and stuff like that. And I used to, like, sneak into the clubs. I'd, like, climb in the window of the bathroom and stuff like that. I did that for a while. And then eventually I realized I needed an ID. So I started to make fake IDs.
Nice.
You know, yeah.
Yeah.
So that was my first foray into crime, you know. And
were they good?
Yeah, they worked. And then what happened was, I had a buddy from school, and he, like, wanted to set up a business where we sell them mm-hmm. to other kids. So I was, like, making IDs for all the kids in the school, and then it just, like, ballooned. I was, like, making them for kids in other schools I had never met before, and I was getting, like, drinking money from them. And, you know, I went to all the bars, and all the bartenders knew who I was and what
the
I
ID
drank.
Guy.
And it was, no, they didn't know I was an ID. They just thought I was a young-looking 18-year-old.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, I became a regular, and then one of the kids got caught, and he came to my business partner. My business partner snitched on me, and I got in trouble. I got that was my first time I got in trouble with the cops, and you know, I was only a kid.
Mm-hmm. I was like, how old were you?
Maybe 15, 16, 15.
Did you get arrested, or were they just like, don't do that?
Well, they came to my house when I wasn't there, and then I got home, and my mother was like, the police were here looking for you. I was like, oh, fuck. and then she says, you have to go in and talk to them. I was like, fuck. So I had to go into the police, like, and the cops were like, the police in Ireland are called the Garda, right?
Garda?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or in an Irish accent, the Garda.
You know, I'm so, loving the... Yeah.
So, like, the IDs had this Garda stamp on them. And the cops thought, like, either I had stole one from the station or they didn't know how I was making these, you know? So I had to go in and...
How were you? How'd you get that little stamp?
So basically the way you do it is... You know how, like, you use an inkjet printer and it comes out and the ink is kind of wet on the paper?
Yeah.
If you get, like, a glossy photo, like an old photo, and you print something on top of the shiny surface, it stays wet and you can use that photo to stamp onto the paper. But the problem was it was backwards, so you got to print it backwards, and then when you stamp it, it's the right way around.
Yeah.
So, like, trying to explain this to the cops, and they were like, Jesus, huh? Jesus, you know, because they didn't know how
they're like, that's smart.
Yeah. And then I was like, oh, I'm sorry, I won't do it again. I only made a couple for my friends, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they believed me and they gave me another chance.
You had a workshop in your basement.
No, I used to make them at home, you know. Yeah. My parents would go, like, you know, my family aren't criminals. I'm the only one in my family who's ever been in trouble before.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the black sheep,
yeah.
You know, so, like, they were mortified, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I would make them when my parents go to bed. I would just get up and make them down the living room, and had these lamination sheets, and you'd use an iron to seal them. So that's how I got started into it. And then it was kind of the same with the drugs. Like, later on, I got into the drugs, first smoking pot and then later ecstasy. And I was broke, so I used to just, like, sell them to get my own. But I always knew loads of people, so the things got away from me. Like, you know, in no time I was, like, sending them all over the country to
different really
people. Like, yeah.
Did you have a website?
No.
Oh, okay.
this would have been like what year? Fuck, I would have been like, I'd say just around 2001.
So, yeah. So how were you sending them? And how were you, like, finding the people who buying them?
At this point, I was in college. So,
yeah.
Like, I was meeting people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one guy would take a few hundred pills to the West Coast. And then...
So you're selling them internationally?
No, not internationally. Just all over the country.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
How did you package them?
No, I would hand them over. I wouldn't mail them. No.
Oh.
Yeah, if you were mailing
you still can't get in trouble for this. I feel like the statute of limitations is over.
I think I'm okay, but I'm not going to, like, tell kids how to get away with stuff.
I'm always interested in how people send things, because a friend of mine used to be, like, a really big weed dealer, and he would take apart things to mail, like, the weed and stuff. And I remember one time he took apart, like, a big old, like, stereo and, like, put it inside that, and, like, that was, like, his trick.
I can tell you exactly how to do it, but I'm not going to tell you on camera because I don't want to, like,
it.
I don't want to encourage kids how to do this.
I don't have a child following.
Yeah, but that's not what I'm trying to do. You know,
okay, like,
my story's about someone who stopped committing crimes. I'm not trying to, like, teach kids.
So we have
this
to have a positive story. We have to have
well,
the
it
positive,
is a positive
spin.
Story, you know. But I'm not going to tell you how to get away with
no
crimes.
No secrets of the trade.
Oh, but I'll tell you, I never snitched on anybody.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one thing I
and
never
And that's how
did.
You get your face bitten.
Well, I got my face bitten because I wouldn't tell the guy information.
That's good that's good.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, snitches get stitches, right?
They do. Yeah, and, you know, I had a few opportunities to do that when I was in trouble at certain times, and I could have done it, but if you do that kind of stuff, you always have to look over your shoulder, and you know, it's not safe for your family, so I never did that, you know. Like, I got caught dealing one time in Ireland, and the cops just said, we just want the bigger fella, give us the bigger fella,
yeah,
and you won't even go to court. So I was like, No, I'm not putting anybody in danger. I'll take my medicine.
Mm-hmm. And then would you repeat back to people like, hey, like, I didn't say anything. Like, you got to know I didn't say anything.
Well, they know. Like, they know once they're not getting arrested, they know I'm cool, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, then obviously, yeah.
What do gangsters in Ireland wear? Do they wear tracksuits?
The thing is, right, when you're involved in that kind of like stuff, I didn't even consider myself to be a gangster until, like, people said that I was, like, it's kind of like if you have buddies who, like, do certain things, you're just friends who happen to be committing crimes.
Mm-hmm.
I never really considered myself to be a gangster, like... You know,
but it's like there's like a relaxed way of saying it, like almost like as if you were saying it to like a cop, like we're just simply like committing a crime. Like there's a softening around it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. But I mean, it's kind of like something the media really says, like, and then I guess when I got sober and everything like that, I was like, well, I guess I kind of was. But at mm-hmm. the time, I wouldn't have said I'm a gangster, you know?
Right. Well, those are the kind of people who are probably like lame and not actually gangster people, and people who are trying to be tough, I would assume.
Or the people who get caught.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're like labeling yourself that.
But to answer your question, like the gangsters in Ireland just like look like regular dudes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they don't, you know how like in America that like certain ones will wear colors and have like tattoos and mm-hmm. signals and shit like that.
Like Bloods and Crips sort of thing.
You don't do any of that kind of crap.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just normal, you know, I guess. So I guess sometimes they wear tracksuits and stuff like that, but it's not like...
I know. Where did that whole thing come from? The tracksuit care? I guess you got
to... Well, it's because it's easy to run in a tracksuit.
Oh, that's so funny. Is that true?
Yeah, it is. I wear tracksuits sometimes, but...
Yeah. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There it is. So where does it grow from there? So you're starting with the IDs, then you're doing the e-pills, and then what's next in terms of this little criminal world you're living in?
Well, yeah, I guess by default I started dealing because I didn't have any money for the drugs, and by selling them I was able to get mine for free. And then at the start... Like, I was the first one of my friends in college to start doing ecstasy, and then all the other guys started doing them. And they were like, oh, get some for me. And then the guy who would get them off was a guy called Tomo. And so Tomo says, Mush, why don't... He calls everybody Mush. So he says, Mush, why don't you get, like, 100 for yourself, and then you can sell some of them, and then you can make a few quid, like... And I was like, no, that's dealing. Like, you know, I'm only a user. Like, if dealing, you get in trouble.
Did you have the double stacked happy faces? I'm trying to remember what I used to take when I was in high school.
My first one was a 007.
Mm.
And there was Mitsubishis. And,
oh, I remember Mitsubishis.
Yeah, there was all those kind of ones. And yeah.
That's so funny.
I'm sure there were probably a different formula from when you got in America.
Yeah.
You know, so I was like, no, I don't want to be a dealer. And Thomas says, Mush, you're already dealing them. I was like, no, I'm not. I'm doing them for free. I'm getting them as a favor.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, Mush, if the cops get you, the charge is for sale or supply. So you're already dealing them. You're doing it for free. If you're doing it, you might as well make a few quid.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, yeah, you're right. Fuck it. I am doing it for free. And if they do catch me, I'm in trouble. Like, you know, so that's kind of how it started. And one thing led to another. And, you know, fast forward, I eventually got to America. You know, I got married really young. I had kids, moved to San Francisco. And when I came to America, I was good for a few years. You know, like, I was just more of a user than a mm-hmm. criminal. But then...
What made you go to San Francisco from Ireland?
That's where my ex-wife was from.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I came over for a summer, and that's how we met. And we had a long-distance relationship, and I went over and back, and mm-hmm. eventually moved over to America. And I kind of thought, like, Ireland was the problem too. Like, maybe if I got out of Ireland, maybe things would be better. But, you know,
it follows.
Ireland wasn't the problem.
Yeah.
I was the problem. Yeah. And then I think around recession time, 2009, mm-hmm. things got tight again, because there was no no work. I was a carpenter.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at that stage, I had a huge coke habit,
mm-hmm.
and I couldn't really afford to be dealing coke, seeing as I wasn't working a whole lot.
Mm.
And So I decided to get into dealing again, just same way by default. At first, I was like selling, I was getting these ounces of coke from...
What were you cutting it with?
I wasn't cutting it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So I was getting these ounces of coke off an Irish guy for like $800. And
so how do you connect with like, how do you find like the Irish connections in America?
A lot of times you work with them, you know?
Oh, okay.
Like in San Francisco, I shouldn't say too much, but... In San Francisco, there's like a group of Asians who like cater to the Irish community, we'll say. Okay. There's one chick actually who has been doing it for a lot of years. Like, and you call her up and she'll say, "Hey, honey, what you want?" And if you want Coke, you say you want a pizza.
Okay.
Want pills, you say you want candy. Mm-hmm. I used to get it off her. You meet guys in bars and then they'll give you the number. And,
yeah.
You know, I was doing my own personal stuff like that. But then I was working with this Irish guy who like said he could give me ounces for 800. So I started getting them off him, but it wasn't that good. And if you're like a drug user, you want the best stuff. Like, and I was getting these ounces and it was taking a long time to sell them because, you know, there was better stuff available. And there was these other Asian gang, and I used to get my own personal stuff off them. It was like slightly more cheaper, but it was like pure, like, you know,
yeah,
fish scale, like
right,
uncut, like rocket fuel. So I was getting my own stuff off these guys, and then I had a brainwave. I was like, why don't I get like weight off these guys? You know, ounces. So the main guy. We'll call him Ronald for the sake of names. And so I said, can I start getting ounces off you guys? And he goes, on one condition. And I was like, what's that? And he's like, if you start getting it off us, you can't get it off anybody else. I was like, why? He said, because we have really good shit. And then if you start selling our stuff and then you start selling crap, it'll ruin our reputation. Yeah. I'm like, okay, that's a commitment, but okay.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah, I get it. So, but he says, there's one other condition. He said, if you ever snitch on us, we'll kill your whole family. And I was like, wow, okay, well, no.
Straight face?
Yeah, I was like, yeah.
Or a laugh after.
No, I was like, well, I've never snitched on anybody before, so I'm not going to start now. And he says, good. If you're ever arrested, just keep your mouth shut and a lawyer will be provided for you.
Mm.
Yeah, so. And then he said, if anybody fucks with you, we'll be up there with machine guns.
Ooh.
So I was like, okay.
Yeah.
Kind of getting serious. So I was working with these guys and, you know, things were getting crazy. I was like doing loads of coke, drinking loads, you know, up to this point. I'd say it was probably 2010 at that point. And I had tried to commit suicide multiple times, like from when I was like 19. You know?
Yeah.
Like I would do so much drugs that I would just get like the highs are really high and the lows really low. Like,
been there.
Yeah. So, you know, I was kind of a mess at that stage. And then something happened. I won't go into the specifics, but somebody hurt somebody I cared about.
Mm.
Right. And
in this world of. This underworld. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. A bad guy. And then I decided I was going to kill this guy.
Nice.
You know, so I talked to Ronald and I was like, will you guys put out a hit on this guy? And he says, we won't do it for money or for personal reasons. We'll only kill someone who's done it in business, like who's messed us over in business.
Mm.
So then I had to like try and find a hitman to kill this guy.
So how do you go about finding a hitman?
Well,
like, where do you start from there? You wake up that day and you're like, right.
In order to find a hitman, first you have to think, who would do it that you know?
Get the role. So you think,
Yeah, so I knew a guy that I worked with. He was like Northern Mexican Mafia that I knew. He was a friend of mine and I used to buy coke off him and his brother. And so I rang him up and his name was Joe. I says, so Joe, can you talk on this line? And he's like, yeah, what's happening? So I told him the situation. I says, this guy needs to be whacked. Like, will you do it for money?
You weren't afraid to have a conversation like that over the phone?
Well, that's why I asked him, can you talk?
Yeah. True.
Yeah, it was probably pretty stupid, but I wasn't doing a lot of blow at the time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, know? Yeah, right. You're not really.
Yeah, so he said, yeah, it'll cost $5,000. So I was like, fuck.
That seems cheap.
Yeah, but I didn't have $5,000. I was like, I'll give you two. Mm-hmm. He's like, no, I'm not going to do that for two.
So was he personally going to do it? Or
yeah.
He, okay.
Nice. Yeah, he was going to do it, but he wanted $5,000. I only had two. Like, and long story short, I was going to rob this place to get the money, and it ended up not happening. And then he got a DUI.
See, that would have been the good movie.
Huh?
See, that's the movie. You're robbing the guy to get the money. You're robbing someone to get the money for
that's the
hit. Yeah,
that's in the book. We won't go into it right now. But anyway, he calls me back a week later and he got a DUI. So he's like, oh, I really need the money. I'll do it for two.
Nice.
So I was like, sweet, okay. But he said, I have to get him the gun because, you know, you have to get a gun to do it. Because
yeah, like a clean gun.
Yeah. So like he wasn't going to spend some of the $2,000 on buying the gun.
And that's so like the bullets can't be traced or something or whatever.
Well, basically, if you have a gun, maybe I shouldn't explain this.
No, please. We have to know.
Okay. So say if you own a gun and it's a legal one in your name.
Yeah.
Or any gun.
Yeah.
If the police do a ballistics check on it, they put it under a microscope, and say if you kill somebody and they pull the bullet out of the body.
Yeah.
They can match up the bullet with that gun. Because every time when it moves down the barrel, little dance on the bullet as it goes through the gun. So they can match it up exactly.
Okay.
So and I had a gun, but it was a legal one, so you can't use your own gun, you know.
So you have to get an illegal gun.
Yeah, or just one that's not yours.
Or one that's not registered.
Yeah, or that's just not yours, it's stolen or something.
Oh, so then you have to steal the gun?
Well, I contacted another guy that I knew who might be able to get me a gun, and and before we got to this point, I had been on a mad bender.
Like,
you know Burning Man?
Yeah, I mean I've never been.
I've never been to it, but I sent a lot of drugs there back in the past. But
I would never go. It seems so disgusting. It's not my vibe.
It's not for me either. But
no,
you know I can't judge anybody. but anyway, I got a call from this guy from Ireland who wanted a half ounce of coke.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I got an ounce of coke and I met this dude and I was like, so what do you do? He goes, I do the funerals, you know. He was an undertaker who was like from Ireland. He was like going to Burning Man and he wanted like half.
Wait, what's an undertaker?
Someone who like buries corpses.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. He's an actual undertaker. Yeah. You know? So I got this half ounce for the undertaker and then the other half went up my nose.
Uh-huh.
So I was awake for a few days, like kind of sleepwalking, drinking loads of vodka. And then at this point, I decided to go to my friend's house to get the gun. So I drive over to the Mission. It's like the Hispanic area in San Francisco. So I don't really remember a whole lot of the conversation, but when he saw me, he was like, I'm not giving this fool a gun.
Because you know? You were so out of it.
Yeah, because I think he thought I was going to get caught or something. So
yeah.
In the end, he was like, no, I can't get you the gun. Or he made some excuse anyway. So I was like, fuck it, I couldn't get the gun. And I'm driving back home and driving through the city. And I have my .22 under the seat. Like, you know, I kept my .22 under the seat. And I had like an ounce of blow in the glove compartment as well. So I'm like driving back. I'm all sweaty. And then the cops started chasing me.
No.
I was like, saw them in the mirror. And they were right behind me. And they followed me for 20 blocks. And I'm like,
my heart... driving carefully?
As carefully as someone can drive after being awake for a few days, all covered in sweat, everything, the lights came on, the siren, and I'm like, fuck, this is it. And then they turned around and went back the other way. They must have got a call or something.
Yeah.
But I pulled over. I nearly had a heart attack. My heart was coming through my chest. And I was like, I'm not going to kill this fool. Like, fucking, I don't want to go to jail for this shit, you know? And then... like the my original guy Ronald from my gang, he had like tried to convince me not to do it because he had told me he had killed people when he was younger and they kind of haunt him and stuff like that, you know. And so I was remembering what he was saying to me, and you know, so I decided I wasn't going to kill the dude, and then I decided to go to Australia. I was like maybe San Francisco's the problem. I'll go to Australia. So went to Australia. That didn't work out either. I was there for
how long?
I was there for like 3 or 4 months, like, you know, but I wouldn't have got on anywhere.
So what did you do when you got there? Just partied?
I did lots of fighting and, you know, messing around with women and building houses.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was involved in some scams over there and stuff.
What kind of scams?
So... at the time there was this thing in Australia where they the Australian government would pay you to update your house for environmental reasons. Okay, so if you have old insulation in your house, take it out and you put in new stuff. So basically what you do is you get your bales of insulation, you go to the house and you go up into the attic and you tap around on the joists up there, pretend you're changing it out and just leave the shit in there. Because it was 120 degrees there in the summer.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to go up to check that shit.
Right.
So I was doing that and, excuse me, other stuff as well, you know, trying to get TVs on finance and not pay for them. And, yeah. And lots of fighting and drinking and misbehaving. And long story short, I missed the kids as well. And I decided to come back and give it another shot with my missus. Like, and then fast forward, like a couple of months later, I'm like suicidal again. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was going to kill myself and I decided not to. And, you know, I was a drug addict, but I was a good enough carpenter. I always could get work. And I used to work with these sober guys up in San Francisco. They were Irish sober guys. And they didn't make any secret of it that they were sober. And one of the guys, Bernard, or in an American accent, Bernard. but we say Bernard. Yeah. But this guy, Bernard, he gave me his number and he says, if you ever want to get sober, give me a call. So I had this guy's number. And I knew I wanted to kill myself. And, you know, I really wanted to stop drinking and doing drugs. And I would be like driving home from work and I could feel myself wanting to go to the bar. Mm. Like I was a bar drinker because I knew alcoholics drink at home. So I would never drink at home.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't want to be an alcoholic. It's like, no, that's alcoholic shit. So I would be driving home from work and I could feel myself being pulled to go to the bar, even though I didn't want.
What kind of bars did you like to go to? Like a dive bar?
Dive bar. Yeah. My spot.
Love
was
a good dive bar.
My spot was the Hockey Haven. Yeah, okay. Yeah, it was a great dive bar up in San Francisco, but they never played hockey. But that was my spot. But yeah, I could feel myself wanting to go to the Hockey Haven. I decided to call Bernard, and you know, I rang him up, and I was like, "Hey, Bernard." He said, "Well, Richie, how's it going?" I says, Bernard, I think I have a problem with the drink and the drugs. Will you take me to a meeting?
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, I'll pick you up this evening. And he brought me to a meeting, and that's how I started going first. I just stayed sober ever since then and did all the shit that he told me to do. And it's been nearly 12 years now.
Oh, really? It has been 12? That's amazing.
Almost, yeah. Yeah.
So then, I don't know about you, but for me in early sobriety, or not in early, for a couple of years still, I was still dipping my toe into living a double life and being really shady. And it took a while. I actually, probably after I relapsed after 3 years, like, and then came back in, I was like, oh, maybe I just wasn't emotionally sober. That, you know what I mean? Like, it still takes a while to get your shit together. So after being involved in this whole world, like, how long did it take to shake that in your sobriety?
Well, I pretty much got it straight away, but there was like loose ends to tie up in terms of, you know, I'm part of this Asian gang and, you know.
How do you pull away from that world?
So I had to call up Ronald and tell him, because like I'm taking an ounce of blow every week. That's 28 grams, you know.
Because you're still having to do that, right?
Well, no, because so basically when I came to the meetings, you know, I realized straight away, shit, the way I'm living is wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, this shit is not right. I can't be sober and continue selling drugs to people. You know, I kind of, it was one thing when I was taking them too, but when I was sober, I was kind of like, nah, I'm giving people the tools to destroy themselves. Like, so I didn't want to do that. So then I had to tell the boys that, you know, your favorite Irish dealer isn't going to be taking any more stuff off you. So I rang him up and I said, hey, Ronald, you know, I'm sober now, so I'm not going to be able to take this off you anymore, you know. And then he said he wanted to meet me. I was like, fuck, well, you know.
Yeah.
Because he usually never wanted to meet me, you know. So he told me to come and meet him on a Saturday. And I didn't know if I was going to get one in the back of the head or not. Because I had never done anything bad to them, you know.
But you knew too much.
No, but like, I knew, I was working with them. So I didn't know what was going to happen.
Where do you meet? Do you meet by the docks? Do you meet, I'm like trying to paint it.
Well, at the time I used to drive a white pickup truck and I'm not going to tell
unmarked.
You. Well, it had a little Irish sticker in the back bumper, but yeah, because it was a pickup truck, but I'm not going to tell you what he drives, but that's.
Where does the mafia want to meet when they're meeting someone in person?
Well, he just wanted to meet in my neighborhood. He told me to come to a certain street and just sat there waiting in my truck. Mm-hmm. And then he got in and I was like, didn't know what was going to happen. And on the radio, Oasis was playing, mm-hmm. You know, Champagne Supernova was actually playing in the thing when he hopped in. And he goes, oh, I'm all about Oasis. That's what he actually said.
That's
I was like, because I'm at this moment where I don't know if I'm going to get shot in the back of the head or not. Like, because that would be the time that it would happen. He'd get in, someone would, you know. But and then I kind of calmed down a little bit when I seen he was legit. But he just wanted to look me in the eye and see that I was telling the truth, you know, because when you're dealing with drug addicts, they're not very honest people. So he just wanted to see if I was for real about being sober and all that. And so I reiterated what I had told him on the phone. And he said, he looked at me and he goes, you know what? You're a good guy. And if you have a problem, you're doing the right thing. Mm. And so I was like, okay, thanks. I appreciate that. You've always been cool with me. And then he offered to buy my customers off me.
Nice.
Yeah, he was like, can I buy your customers off you? And I'm like, you can have them.
Aww.
I was like, I didn't want any money from them, you know? And he goes, no, I want to pay you for them. I think that'll be right. And I was like, no, I don't want anything. I really want to be out of it. He goes, no, you don't have to see anything. You don't have to touch anything. I'll give you residual income every week if you just pass on the people. I was tempted by that, but at the same time, I was like, no, you know.
That's hard to turn that down.
Well, it was more harder for me to upset him in a way, mm-hmm. but it wasn't upsetting him. He was just trying to keep me somehow mm-hmm. involved. But
yeah, because you're still linked then.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think they know what they're doing when they do that, too.
Yeah, he was a really sharp guy. He was an investment banker back then as well, like, you know. Like, these guys were organized crime. They weren't mm-hmm. dumbass.
It's organized.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So I just said, no, you can have them. You know, I don't want anything, but thank you anyway. So I agreed to, like, pass on my customers. But, like, pretty much all of them were too scared to meet them. Like, mm-hmm. I think maybe one or two did, like, you know. But the funny thing was, after I got sober and I started going to the meetings, they're like, okay, I'm like, how do you get sober? So I was doing all the things that they suggested to me. And they were like, oh, you should try and help other people get sober. And like some of my customers like were nearly as, were even, some of them were even worse than me in terms of the mm-hmm. addiction. Like there was one guy, he worked for the city of San Francisco and he was one of my neighbors actually. And he was a really good dude. But before I got sober, when I would be bringing him the coke, I used to see him and I'd be like, this fucking guy has a problem. And I'd be like, yeah. I'd be like I had a problem too, but I was like, it's like, you want to fucking cop yourself on or I'm not going to give you any shit anymore. Like, you know, mm-hmm. So he was like top of my list, you know? So he goes, hey Richie, you got any coke? And I was like, come over. So I came over, but I didn't really have any coke cause I was finished at that point. So I came in like, and he was like, where's the coke? I was like, there's these meetings you can go to. And if you go, you don't have to take drugs no more. And do you want to come with me? And he looked at me like as if I was crazy. He was like,
that's so funny.
Like, meetings? I was like, yeah. And he goes, I don't have a problem. I was like, what? He goes, no. He thought it was extreme. He was like, no, you go to your meetings. So
you tried.
I tried, yeah. But I kind of figured like, I had found the solution that I was looking for a long time. And I kind of thought like, oh, maybe other people would like to. But then I realized, you know, just because I want to be sober doesn't mean everybody wants to be,
mm-hmm.
you know. So, yeah, that was kind of strange. But, yeah, that was the main way of getting out of it. And, you know, part of being sober, you have to make amends to people you've hurt and stuff like that. I did that stuff, too. And, you know, you've been to the meeting.
Yeah, it was what I thought was the craziest thing about making the amends is the people who I was like, Like, you know, the ones that felt like the little amends ended up being the bigger deal amends. Mm-hmm. Like the people who I was like, oh, I'm going to apologize to, you know, like my old roommates from college, because I was like a really crazy roommate and like I was in a crazy relationship and I definitely have to make amends to them because I was like crying and psychotic every day and causing a lot of drama. And they were like, oh my God, thank you so much. Like, I'm so proud. And I was like, whoa. And it seemed like it had such a bigger effect on the people who I didn't think would.
Yeah.
And it's funny. Yeah. I like made a financial amends to my dad and I didn't want to. And I was like, I used to steal money out of your wallet. Like, do you want me to pay you back? He's like, sure. I was like, fuck. Yeah, I made an amends to my dad for being a stripper because he found out. And like, that was like a huge deal and so uncomfortable to have to sit across from him and do that. But he knew, and it like, because one of his friends caught me when I was working and told my dad. And like, so just to sit across from him and like apologize for embarrassing him was like a huge deal. I mean, like, it's just crazy where amends take you. And
But so your dad's friend was at the strip club and saw you there?
Yeah.
Oh.
And I was so fucked up and high on coke, and I was like, please don't tell him, please don't tell him. And he told him, and my dad texted me, this is so sad, you just broke my heart.
Oh.
And I was so high on coke, I like was like, I was like, put this out of my head, like, don't even like think about it. You know, like when you're so fucked up. But it was like the saddest text to receive.
Yeah. I can imagine.
At like 5 a.m., you know? And then I was like, oh, well. And then, you know, I was in such a dark place that I like couldn't even, I wouldn't let myself sit with it. And I just went on partying. But,
yeah, I know the feeling.
Yeah. It's, yeah. So it's great to be able to make amends. I mean, it's crazy how like some people don't even work all the steps, you know? So it's
I needed that. It was a bad case.
Yeah. So then you decided to write a book about the Gangster's Guide to the 12 Steps. Is that the...
Yeah. So basically, so did I tell you about how I became an actor?
Oh, no. Please get into that.
Well, yeah, because that happened first.
Take us on this journey.
Okay. So after I got sober, I was like, no more criminal shit, you know, no more violence, no more cheating on the missus, and, trying to be a good guy, right? And so things were going great for a while, right? Had nearly a year sober, and, you know, I just got my contractor license because I wanted to be a contractor. And, you know, I was doing this remodel on a house and beam fell down and hit me, broke my back, and my back was like permanently damaged.
Ugh.
So I was like, fuck. And I got a bunch of operations on it.
How much did that hurt, by the way, when you break a back?
It hurt a lot, like, but I had like one broken disc and one herniated disc. Like, one of my discs was broken in two. I've actually had more painful stuff than that.
Wow.
Yeah. But like, I had to get a tooth removed that was actually more painful than that, would you believe? But yeah, the boys at the meetings, they told me, like, if you get any operations, you want to watch the pain meds. Mm-hmm. If you take those, you can relapse.
So, yeah.
So I was really careful about that stuff. I never took any of the pain meds. I kind of toughed it out, but...
You had to go with the ibuprofen 800s.
Ibuprofen is, like, as far as I go, you know? Like, so... I was like, I expected everything was going to be cool once I stopped being bad and, you know, was sober, and then lost my whole livelihood and I lost all my money. I didn't have a whole lot of money from the dealing anyway, you know, because I was my own best customer. So,
right.
So it wasn't like I was making millions or anything like that. Literally everything I made was spent every week, you know. So, all my legit money was gone, and I was at a meeting one time, and this girl that I knew like told me I should be a model. I didn't really believe her, but I was open to suggestions because I had no other options. And I got signed to like a small modeling agency, and I did a little bit of it. And there's a website called Model Mayhem.
I remember my
photos. And this guy contacted me. He was the director, and he was doing like a low budget short film, and he asked me to be in the movie, and he said he was looking for a German gangster, And he says, don't take this the wrong way, but you have that look about you.
You do.
Yeah. I do play Germans a lot. But yeah, so I didn't tell him that I used to be a gangster. I didn't scare him or anything. But I did the role, and it was like I told you, I was literally tied to a chair getting beaten to a pulp in the thing. And I was like, I have this inside joke that this shit has really happened to me.
Yeah.
And I guess it telegraphed because it was a good fit for the thing. And then I ended up playing that exact same stuff in MacGyver and this other show on Hulu. So, yeah, I enjoyed the acting way more than the modeling. So I was like, I want to do this. So I started taking classes and moved to L.A. a year later. So I'm in L.A. like 9 years now. And then the roles just got bigger. And, you know, I speak a lot at meetings. People ask me a lot because I have a strange story and, you know, I'm an Irishman. There's not a whole lot of Paddies in L.A. So they're like, oh, he talks funny. Let's have him speak. Mm-hmm. So I'm like speaking at all these meetings. And a lot of people have said to me, I should write a book.
Mm-hmm.
And like I meant to get around to it. And eventually I started writing down all my experiences and got them all down on paper. And, you know, it was like 105,000 words, which is like 430 pages.
How long did that period take when you're writing?
I wrote it pretty quick. I wrote it in a couple of months, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
every day?
Yeah. Yeah.
Were you very like disciplined? Like, okay, I'm going to sit down. I'm going to work on my book. Just from like a writing perspective and discipline.
I wrote it on my phone.
Oh, you did?
I wrote the whole book on the old phone.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I after I became an actor, I did all these broke-ass actory jobs for a little while, and I won't say where it is, but I'd be at work just writing my book on my phone.
Yeah.
So I had the whole book written out, and around the same time, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, one of my buddies, Sean, he's another actor, moved down from the Bay down here with me. We're pretty close friends. He had a comedy project that he had been working on, and he was willing to make me a producer on it if I can get some famous people attached, you know. So it was a comedy, so I reached out to a couple of comedy people, tried Danny McBride first, and Danny McBride's assistant got back and he said, no, Danny doesn't take unsolicited material.
Yeah, right.
And then I hit up John Altshuler, you know, because he's one of the creators of Silicon Valley, and one of the best comedies at the time, and well, ever actually. And he got back to me, and we met, and he was really cool. And you know, Sean's project ended up not going anywhere, but he said, you know, keep sending me stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I sent him a couple of other things. He wasn't interested, and then I finished writing the book. So I sent him the book, and he said, yeah, this is kind of cool, but I don't really know where it's going.
Mm-hmm.
He had like read 50 pages.
Mm-hmm.
And by that stage, it wasn't obvious that I had become a gangster. You know, and I told him, and then he said, let's meet again. And we had coffee again, and he had no idea that I used to be a gangster. Like, I'm not scary, like I'm friendly, you know. And so I told him some yarns, and he's like, wow, this is amazing. Do you want a partner on it? And I was like, yeah, okay. And
so let me pause for a second. So you contacted a writer on like a super popular show.
Yeah, I sent him a cold email. He did
a cold email. Yeah. How did you keep that relationship continuing? And like, how did you keep it? Like, how did you keep him interested? You know what I mean? Like,
well, it literally happened within 2 months of meeting him.
Mm-hmm.
So like, we met that one time, and he was really cool, and he got on well with me and Sean, and he's a genuinely nice guy, you know, yeah, it literally just happened that fast.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then so first, you know, he has a project that's coming out. I'm not allowed to talk about it, but basically it's about somebody who is a famous writer, and he put us in touch with his book agent. So we sent my original manuscript over to the book agent, and she read it like twice, and she's like, this is a crazy story, but I don't know what the hell to do with it.
Right. Yeah.
So John came up with the idea of like rewriting the book thematically based on the 12 steps. So we redid the book together, me and him and Dave. Dave is his partner, Dave Kinski. And that's how it became The Gangster's Guide to Sobriety, My Life in 12 Steps, because there's 12 chapters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there's like the A storyline of how I got sober, and then the B storyline is like flashbacks to all this crazy stuff that happened to me.
Mm.
Yeah, so we rewrote the book.
And how long did that take?
That was a while. Probably about, I'd say about a year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then how did you work with them on the rewrites for that? Like, what was that process like?
Oh, it was cool. Like, we just emailed each other back and forth, because I think at this stage the pandemic had started, and, mm-hmm. you know, yeah, it was really cool. They're easy to work with. They're fast, you mm-hmm. know. And
but do you do like a Google Doc and you're all looking at the same doc, or like what's like
we do like a Microsoft Word doc uh-huh. and then send it to each other, and we confer, and then the publisher put us with an editor as well, and we worked with him too. He was great. Mm-hmm. Jacob Hoy is his name for Post Hill. He was a great editor too. So between the four of us, we put it all together.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's coming out on May 24th.
So then you finish the book and the agent says, this is great, I'm going to sell this. And then the writers say...
Well, we got the book deal before we even had it written.
So, okay.
So we had 14 publishers interested.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did that just like blow your mind?
Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty crazy. And we went with Post Hill and they agreed to do it before we even had the manuscript, so mm-hmm. we worked with them on.
Oh, so on the pitch alone.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Yeah, they're really cool guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and yeah. Then were you worried at all that anything that you talked about would, like, something from your past would, someone would get upset or like?
I'm sure some people will be upset.
Yeah, but you change names.
Well, yeah, the lawyers make you change all the names anyway. There was a couple of people who didn't want their names changed. There's a couple of real names in there. Mm-hmm. So some of the gangsters said they wanted their real names. Yeah, yeah. So yeah, but it's all true, you know. And the names are changed, and some of the details are changed to protect identity. So.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have any existing beefs with anybody, so I'm not worried about anything.
And now, are you planning on taking the book and trying to make it into a series?
Yeah, it's going to be a series. Yeah, can't say too much about it, but there's a lot of people interested in it, and you'll hear more about it.
Yeah, yeah. That's so cool. So, like, how funny is that? That just, like... how everything just kind of like flows along, like sort of like, oh yeah, I'll try that. And well, then it just kind of like all falls together.
It took a couple of years. It didn't just happen overnight. But
no,
was,
I
yeah,
know, but I'm saying just like keeping like an open attitude and energy with and like flowing with like what's kind of coming in. Like, oh yeah, I'll try that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's cool when things work out for sure. Yeah. And it really does help if you meet the right people. Like,
right.
You know, working with John and Dave was great. And mm-hmm. I still enjoy working with them.
That's so cool. And then how funny is it that you continued to play gangsters in movies and TV shows? So is that like, you're like, at this point, I'm just going to do headshots geared towards that kind of role?
Yeah, I was told to do that. Like the first acting class I went to, you know, most good acting classes will tell you
your type.
What's your type?
Mm-hmm.
It's different in Europe. In Europe, they kind of allow you to play anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'll see over there people play all kinds of stuff. But in America, they kind of put you in a box. And at the very start in the acting class, they were like, you're a villain. you're a bad guy. And I was like, okay, could be worse.
That's so funny.
Yeah. So I got headshots taken like that. And, you know, pretty much all the jobs I got was from auditioning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, didn't get any of them handed to me. So nobody really knew about my past or anything like that. It was just went for the role the same as everybody else. And that's how I booked them.
Do you have any crazy audition stories?
What do you mean, like crazy?
Just like, what the fuck did I just do? I remember one time in a commercial audition, I looked down at a fake watch that wasn't on my wrist. You know, like you just do things in the moment.
Yeah.
And then I was like, why the fuck did I just do that? And then when I left, my friend happened to be the casting director. And she was like, that was psycho. And I was like, and then I spent the whole car ride home looking down at my fake watch, replaying, like, what the fuck did I just do? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I guess when I was new in town, I didn't know how to play it in terms of, so like I'm an Irishman, but I'm never going for Irish rolls. They usually want like people red hair and freckles. So I'm always up for some other shit. And so it was, I didn't know, you know, when you come into an audition, obviously before pandemic, after, since the pandemic, it's all tapes. There's not really many in person anymore. But like in the old days before the pandemic, you come into the room and you say, hey, how you doing? You do your slate and then you do your performance. So I didn't know, should I let them know I'm really Irish or just fucking play whatever I'm supposed to be when I go in? And I experimented with different ways. So like at the start, I was honest about it. So I go, hey, I'm Richie. How you doing? You know, the Irish accent. And then I do my thing. But I noticed when I do it that way, they're watching me to see how good my accent is instead of the acting.
Mm.
So I was like, and people told me I should pretend to be American or whatever the fuck I am as the character. So then I started doing that. And then I thought it would be cool to like say hi as an American, do the role as an American, and then afterwards go, by the way, I'm Irish, you know. But people get mad about being tricked. So I noticed like a couple of times people were perturbed by that. So then I just like don't tell them I'm Irish, and then they figure out afterwards and they go, oh, he's Irish, that's cool. But I don't trick them anymore in the room, or, you know.
You ever go in acting American, do the audition as Irish if it's for a character, or like an English character or something, and then you end with American? They're like, he was incredible. Like, he really just like went into that accent.
Yeah. So, you know, sometimes, so I did this TV show called Major Crimes, and the character was supposed to be from Manchester, but I decided I'd make him Cockney, you know, because I can do 50 different accents.
You can?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Can you spitball through a couple of them?
Okay. So Irish ones, you know, I'm Dublin and talk like that. Arnie, that's the story. That's the working class accent from Dublin, you know what I mean? And if you're from Northern Ireland, you say, I'm from Northern Ireland. That's a bottle of water there. Doing a podcast with Chelsea Skedmore at the Comedy Store. And then there's like where I'm from is like really redneck. So like they're like, how's it going there? You're on the podcast, are you? You and Chelsea Skidmore below in the Comedy Store. That's like where I'm from. They kind of sound like that. The rednecks, like. But yeah, I can do all these accents. So
what about English ones?
I can do a few different English ones. Like on Major Crimes, I was a Cockney, innit? And then Manchester's like that. You all right, mate? Liverpool is like, hey, how's it going? Chelsea Skidmore podcast. That's a Comedy Star. And then there's a ton of different ones, you know.
I like the Cockney one.
Yeah, so I did the
Cockney. That's like the Guy Ritchie one,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's so for Major Crimes, that character was supposed to be from Manchester. And I just said, fuck it, like, I'll make a Cockney, just take a shot, even though the character isn't. And all the other people who were going for it, they were playing it as Manchester because at the callback. So before pandemic, you have callbacks and you come into the building and you and the other four or five finalists.
Who look just like you.
Yeah, yeah. They all go into the room and you take turns and you come out. And I could hear them from inside the room. All the other dudes were doing it as Manchester. So I kept with the Cockney and I came in, I did it, and four or five producers were there and they were like, wow, that was great. And then yeah, I said, thanks. And then they asked me, are you really from London? And then I'm like, no, I'm from Ireland. And then they're like, ah, no, yeah, they thought it was cool. And then I booked the role.
Love it.
So, yeah, yeah, it's, and, you know, even one of the tricks I do, here's a trick for the actors. So whenever you're doing your slate, so if you're not an actor, when you're doing a tape for an audition, you do the role. And then you do a separate take of saying, hi, my name's Richie Stevens. I'm 6'2", da, da, da. So that's a slate. So I always do the slate as the character. So like if the character is an evil Russian gangster, I'll say, my name is Richie Stevens. I am 6'2", based in Los Angeles, you know, as well. So sometimes that can give you a little bit of extra.
I like that.
Yeah. Somebody told me that that's a cool thing that I do.
Yeah, I love it. Well, Thank you so much, Richie, for coming on. So tell us about the book, when it's coming out, where we can find you on social and all that.
Thanks very much for having me, Chelsea. It was a lot of fun. So the book's coming out on May 24th, 2022. You'll be able to get it at Amazon, Simon & Schuster, Barnes & Noble, Audible. I do the voice of it as well. And if you guys want to find out any more information about me, you can see it on IMDb. And I'm on Instagram as Richie Actor. And if you guys enjoyed this with Chelsea, please like and subscribe.
Thank you. Bye.